vaccine. It was approved by the European Medicines Agency for use across the EU, but following a widespread vaccination campaign, 1,800 people, primarily children and young adults under 30, developed debilitating narcolepsy that causes excessive and often uncontrollable drowsiness. So is this happening too fast?
Apparently the MHRA, the Medicines and Health Regulatory Authority in this country, has put out a tender, which was put out through the EU. I think that's how it got picked up into the news. But this tender is for an artificial intelligence system, which they're saying is necessary to spend public money on that because there are going to be a very high level of adverse events. Now, we obviously have had vaccination in this country for a very long time, mass vaccination programs on a routine basis. So that's quite surprising because we've got all of these other vaccines with a system which copes with their adverse events. But apparently now we need an entire new standalone system because the level of adverse events expected are going to be kind of off the scale of what our existing systems can handle.
Children will not be immunised, but the British government has not ruled out making the vaccines compulsory for adults. Westminster is mulling ways to incentivise getting the jab first. People may need an immunity passport or QR code on their phone to attend football matches, the theatre and other events like the Tokyo Olympics. Qantas Airlines have already announced that proof that you've been vaccinated will be compulsory on its flights. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Iran, Cuba and Venezuela host a virtual seminar at the UN headquarters in Vienna on unilateral sanctions and their impacts in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. The three countries are under crippling US sanctions that have added extra pressure as they struggle to fight the coronavirus. Banking restrictions resulting from the sanctions are affecting the country's ability to obtain medical equipment, a point highlighted by the UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. Iran's ambassador to international organizations in Vienna, Qasem Gharibabadi, said as the world's biggest imposer of unilateral sanctions, the US should be held accountable for the consequences of its actions.
These sanctions violate human rights in the current circumstances. In our country, we also face a problem in importing medicine and medical equipment from abroad as a result of these cruel, unilateral, coercive measures and banking restrictions. Those who impose these sanctions have international responsibilities.
The Cuban ambassador said many countries are unaware of the impact that these sanctions are having on countries' healthcare systems and people's normal day-to-day lives.
As a result of this seminar, we will try to impulse all declaration in all resolution of the United Nations to include the request to the United States and the other country and the European country who impose unilateral coercive measure to lifting those measures as the Secretary General of the United Nations requests and the High Commissioner of Human Rights.
In a joint statement, representatives of 38 participating countries said unilateral coercive measures are against international law, human rights and the UN Charter.
Under the current circumstances caused by the coronavirus, they said, sanctions have made targeted countries vulnerable and need to be lifted. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
We are told that EU officials are monitoring the situation in the Middle East very closely as tensions escalate over the assassination last Friday of senior Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The 27-nation bloc's foreign policy spokesperson, Peter Stano, gave this reaction when we spoke to him via Skype.
What happened on Friday in the city of Abzaq is a criminal act and runs counter to the principle of respect for human rights on which or for which the European Union is standing for.
One EU lawmaker says Israel orchestrated the attack under false pretenses and in cahoots with the Trump administration to try and scupper Joe Biden's plans to re-engage with Iran in 2021.
People should remember that Iran has no nuclear weapons, despite for the last 25 years Israel crying wolf that they could develop one. Israel has nuclear weapons. So, I mean, which is the bigger danger to peace in the region?
Political commentators say the EU has a pattern of issuing strongly worded statements, but will once again shy away from taking any firm steps against Israel. They say the bloc has turned a blind eye to repeated international law violations perpetrated by Israel and Saudi Arabia. Apparently, this is because the EU does not want to upset the United States, but also trade in weapons and goods to these regimes is worth billions of euro annually. The big question now is, how might Tehran respond to Fakhrizadeh's murder? And what impact could any such response have on ambitions under a Biden presidency to save the Iran nuclear deal? Tehran has always insisted its nuclear energy program is purely peaceful. Security analysts say the Israeli regime and the very powerful Israel lobby in Washington have shown time and time again the last thing in the world they want is peace with Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran has held a funeral ceremony for its top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was assassinated near Tehran on Friday. Due to coronavirus, only senior government and military officials attended the event. Addressing the participants, Iranian Defense Minister Amir Khatami said assassinating Iranian scientists is an indication of the enemy's defeat. The defense minister vowed a crushing response to the perpetrators of the attack.
Every criminal activity, every assassination or terror will be responded. The enemies must know that they will receive a crushing response and that we will act in accordance with the order of Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Iranian Defense Minister's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the city of Absert, east of the capital Tehran. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but he succumbed to his wounds. He had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program. This made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
History has shown that the actions of the enemies will not be left unanswered. We will take revenge. We will punish all those who ordered and those who carried out this terrorist attack.
The main perpetrators of these terrorist attacks against my father should wake up to this reality that this path will continue and his blood will make his name remain in history for good. They can do nothing.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Iranian officials have vowed a crushing response to the main perpetrators of the attack against Dr. Fakhrizadeh, saying his path will continue much more resolutely than ever before. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the United Nations on November 29 in 1977. The day is marked every year internationally with rallies and activities aimed at drawing attention to the struggle of the Palestinian people. This year, a protest was held in the village of Khan al-Ahmar that is under a threat again to be demolished by the Israeli military. On this day, Palestinians assured they will continue to defend their lands amid calls by the Palestine Liberation Organization to enable the Palestinians to exercise their right to self-determination and their independent state.
We are still struggling to protect our basic rights against Israeli regime violence. Meanwhile, our dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. We have come here to voice our protest against Israel's aggression. We are the real owners of these lands.
This year, however, Palestinians say they were left alone struggling the Israeli occupation and its non-stop attempts to annex more lands, mainly after some Arab states have signed normalization deals with Tel Aviv. These ties, Palestinians say, simply undermine efforts for Palestinian state. Palestinian officials stressed that what they see as a symbolic international solidarity has failed to give the Palestinian people their rights, while Israel continues to occupy most of the land of historical Palestine.
Israel will not be deterred by statements of condemnation. Israel can be stopped only by popular nonviolent Palestinian struggle and boycott, divestment, sanctions against its system of apartheid. That's what we want to see. BDS, not normalization with occupation.
The UN, meanwhile, has renewed commitment to the Palestinian people. However, its Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has cautioned that the prospects for a viable two-state solution are becoming more distant, mainly with Israel's expansion of illegal settlements, a significant spike in the demolition of Palestinian homes and structures, violence, and continued militant activity. After more than 40 years since the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the UN, Palestinian rights remain usurped and the dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Venezuela's judiciary has convicted a group of former oil executives who plotted with the U.S. government against the interests of the South American country Citgo Petroleum Corporation, which is based in the United States. The judicial ruling comes at a time when Caracas is fighting to regain control of Citgo, as the company was illegally confiscated by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. Citgo's former executives were found guilty of passing secret information to American authorities in order to inflict damage on Venezuela's oil industry, a misconduct that is regarded as a major crime in Venezuela. In this scenario, officials support the judicial verdict.
The judge's decision is aimed at protecting our country's oil industry from U.S.-funded spies like ex-Citgo executives.
On the flip side, the opposition criticizes this legal case.
There is not enough evidence of conspiracy between the former executives and the U.S., so this court ruling is politically motivated.
Nonetheless, experts say the country's judiciary issued the right verdict.
The former executives are the Venezuelans who hold U.S. citizenship. That's a felony itself, in case you are the manager of a Venezuelan company.
Venezuela's judiciary has punished the former oil executives for their complicity with the U.S. Analysts say this is part of Caracas's legal actions to get back Citgo, the oil company that was illegally confiscated by Washington. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
Secondly, the Sacred Defense gave self-confidence to our nation. The confidence that you sometimes witness in a large number of our people in the arena of science and many other arenas, industry and other such areas originates primarily from the Sacred Defense. During the war, a 20-plus-year-old could rally a crowd and an army behind himself with complete power and self-confidence and he would deliver a serious blow to the enemy. Well, such things give self-confidence and assurance to the people. The sacred defense succeeded in proving that the Iranian nation would be able to pass through the morass of an imposed war with honor.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Moreover, we achieved our movement towards technological and scientific innovation during the sacred defense era. This is because we needed many things during the sacred defense, but we did not have access to them. We did not have the necessary resources, but our pious and altruistic forces thought of building and manufacturing them. For example, the late Shahid Hassan Tehrani Muqaddam launched the missile manufacturing endeavor. Once, he as well as others asked to go and pay a visit to their achievements. Well, when we went there and witnessed that they had really begun the endeavor, well, we needed missiles, but they would not give them to us. The enemy had missiles and he would strike us with them. This made our talented forces think of doing something, and they did a brilliant job. They did it in the best way possible, which has continued until the present time. So, the movement towards innovation was another blessing of it.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
The debate.
When a country's top scientist gets assassinated through targeted killing, the government reaction is one of anger and retaliation. That is exactly how Iran has reacted in terms of Iran's parliament. It has taken retaliatory measures like advancing its uranium enrichment for its civilian nuclear program, and also to start up its heavy water reactor, along with advancing its centrifuges. Now, unlike most countries in West Asia, the Iranian Foreign Ministry and the government have, however, disagreed on this matter. In this debate, we will discuss what those disagreements are and where that leaves Iran with the international community. Let me introduce our guests for this edition of the debate. We have Farhang Jahanpour, who's an academic and political analyst, who joins us from Oxford, UK. Also, Sam Mahdi Torabi, director of the Risalat Strategic Studies Institute, who joins us from Qom. I'd like to welcome you both. Sam Mahdi Torabi, let me first start with you. You know what has gone down in terms of, at this point, what the Majlis has done and where the Iranian government has disagreed with those steps. But if you can please lay out the groundwork for us and then, of course, add your introspective analysis to that.
Sure. First of all, let's be very clear that it is something completely normal in a vibrant constitutional state like the Islamic Republic is for the different independent branches of government to have difference of opinion. It has happened hundreds of times in the last 40 years. So I kind of disagree with the framing of the debate. It is the constitutional duty of the Majlis to be as an independent branch of government, to give its opinions, give its oversight. Oversight is part of the role of the Majlis under the Constitution of Iran, and it has done this. And it is also nothing new that the sitting administrations of the various administrations that we've had throughout the 40 years will disagree with many things that the Majlis does. The good thing about the Islamic Republic of Iran is, as I said, we have a constitution, we have rules, we have a thing called the National Supreme National Security Council, which is the place where all these debates are then brought together, all the branches of government, the executive, the legislative, judiciary, all the relevant pieces of the various parts of the government that we have, because it's not the government disagreeing, it's the administration disagreeing. The government is a larger is the larger establishment. It is debated and discussed in the National Security Council, and then the National Security Council makes a decision. And the final word on all these matters, on all these strategic matters, are, of course, with the leader of the Islamic Revolution. And so, as with all other cases, including the JCPOA itself and other things that happened, including the response that we had to the assassination of Haj Qasim, this will be discussed in the Supreme National Security Council with the final word by the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
Okay, so please tell us, I don't want to say which side you're on, but tell us what you think about the steps taken by both. And in terms of the disagreement, and then who you agree with, perhaps.
Well, again, it's not about that. I disagree with the framing of the debate. The debate is that, for example, the Majlis has pointed out certain things that were in the JCPOA that Iran voluntarily decided to do, which is, for example, having the additional protocol, which is something that Iran did as a voluntary act. So, in its role, in its constitutional role, the Majlis is allowed to pass a resolution or pass a law saying that we will no longer implement the additional protocol. And the administration is free to disagree with that, or as the other things you mentioned, such as uranium enrichment, raising the level, or taking certain advances. By the way, let me just also add that all of these things are legal under the JCPOA. The JCPOA was not an agreement in which Iran gave any sort of promise to completely end everything. All the steps that Iran has taken since the non-implementation of the JCPOA by the Europeans and by when the Americans left, all of it has actually happened as part of the rules that govern the JCPOA. So again, it's not about this kind of thing that people, for example, maybe in the foreign media would like to point out, that there is some sort of a fundamental disagreement. We have a vibrant state. We have a vibrant political system. Governments disagree. Different administrations that come to power have different views. Parliaments, the majorities in parliaments changed. As we saw in the last parliamentary election, we had a different majority than we had in the previous parliament. So in my view, this is all a sign of the health and of the strength of our system. And when it comes to security matters, we have a very mature system in which security matters are determined by the Supreme National Security Council with the approval of the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
Okay, so let me come to you now, Fahang Jahanpour. Just taking a look from the outside into what has happened, you're looking at one of the top scientists in the nuclear arena, also in the medical arena, because Fakhrizadeh was also aiding and cooperating in vaccine development for COVID-19. You have him being assassinated on Iranian soil in the form and manner that he has. And that's in a string of scientists that have been assassinated inside Iran. The natural reaction is for the parliamentarians in this case in point to come out in anger, and you know, quite rightly so, again, from the outside looking in. And you're looking at an environment where you're also looking at a president, which may be outgoing at this point, who was mulling attacking Iran. The reaction in the form of some of the steps that they have taken and provisions that they have enacted, it may be a natural outcome of what has occurred. Do you think that they are right in introducing and passing some of the bills and provisions that they have?
Well, thank you very much for having me. First of all, there is no question about it that the assassination of a scientist in Iran, Mr. Fakhrizadeh, was an act of terrorism. And many people in the West, too, have condemned it as an act of terrorism, act of state terrorism. The question is how you react to something like that. Of course, as was mentioned by Mr. Turabi, there are always differences within any kind of government, East or West, and Iran is no exception. And it is the right of the parliament to challenge the government, to ask questions, to put forward different ideas, provided they do not impede the government from acting in the best interests of the country. I think, as I said before, the act has to be condemned and was an act of terrorism, that Iran should not fall into the trap of those who wish to make Iran take some provocative action, which would then justify further military action against Iran. I think Iran has shown in the past that it can act in a strategic, considered, measured way to these provocations, and I hope that they will do the same this time too.
Samahti Torabi, let's break down what the foreign ministry spokesman has said, Said Khatibzadeh, which is telling in some ways. Iranian parliament's efforts, which also included ending nuclear inspections, has met immediate opposition from the government. The government has explicitly announced that it does not agree with this plan, which it considers neither necessary nor useful.
Well, again, the place where Iran's national interest will be determined is the Supreme National Security Council. So the good thing about having a Supreme National Security Council is that neither the administration, whatever the sitting administration is, nor the Majlis has the final say in this. So yes, just as it is the right of the Majlis to have its views, and of course a lot of the members of Majlis that were voted this time around explicitly stated that they are coming because they want to change the course that the Rouhani administration has taken, a view that I share with these parliamentarians. I don't believe that you should have strategic negotiations with the West when you don't have strategic deterrents, such as missiles and such as having military power. After you have military power and you have strategic deterrents in the form of missiles and ICBMs, then you can sit and negotiate about whatever you want to negotiate about. I feel that there was a part of the elite in Iran which jumped the gun on this and was a bit too scared and didn't wait long enough to have for Iran to develop its... But that's not the issue. The issue is that if the administration has this view or the parliament has this view, neither of which is the one that's authoritative in the end. It will go to the Supreme National Security Council. There, it will be discussed in a process which involves all branches of governments. It involves the military, it involves the intelligence agencies, and it, of course, involves the leadership. And whatever decision that Supreme National Security Council takes, whether it is to agree with the parliament in some of the things that it has done, or whether it is to agree with the administration, that's going to be the result. So again, this idea that somehow the administration or the foreign ministry in any way, shape, or form is the final authority on this is not the reality of the way that the constitutional system in Iran works.
Okay. There is a very important point here that is made from Saeed Khatibzadeh, the foreign ministry spokesperson, statements, Farhang Jahanpour, that I think if you can elaborate on us for us a little bit or give your thoughts on it. And that is the issue of Iran's nuclear policy. Obviously a very sensitive area. Iran has always backed and provided assistance, for example, the IAEA, when it comes to its civilian nuclear program. And of course, then it was negotiated in the JCPOA in terms of the provisions, etc. And the government has said that the move could not change Iran's nuclear policy. But at the same time, you're having the assassination to take place, and you're having this in addition to all the threats that the U.S. has always pretty much, in their famous words, all options are on the table, to have given Iran. And they are saying, under this lifting of sanctions umbrella, to fast-track this, within 2 months, have sanctions lifted. They're asking the Europeans that. So can you put these two issues into perspective for us?
Well, I think some people tend to forget where we were in the past and where we are at the moment. Before the JCPOA, Iran was under five Security Council resolutions imposing sanctions on Iran under Chapter 7, which means it was threatening international peace and security. Iran was isolated to the extent that even China and Russia, which claimed to be Iran's friends, joined in the sanctions against Iran. The JCPOA completely changed the situation. I was reading an interview between Mr. Biden and the CNN just a couple of months ago, and he said that before, when the JCPOA was passed, Iran became part of the international community. Europeans came on our side to agree. Russia and China came to our side to agree. But as a result of what Trump has done, we are now isolated, and Iran is increasing its nuclear activities. And he's absolutely right. America, especially Mr. Pompeo, tried to put a snapback through the Security Council. The result was completely embarrassing and shameful for America. The whole world unanimously took Iran's side, and America was isolated. Let's not forget these facts. The fact of the matter was, there is a difference between an Obama administration and a Trump administration, as we have seen. Trump withdrew illegally from the JCPOA and imposed crippling, unprecedented sanctions on Iran, and we can see the economic results of it. Mr. Biden is promising that he would return to the JCPOA if Iran also goes back to the full implementation. Iran, as you know, after the United States withdrew, waited for a year. But after a year, as Europeans could not change the situation, began to increase its enrichment above the levels allowed in the JCPOA. All that Mr. Biden is saying is that he would return to the JCPOA if Iran also returns to where it was prior to Trump withdrawing. I think that's a very fair solution, because we are not in a very strong position, neither are they in a very strong position. What Iran must not do is again to isolate herself in the international community and push the Europeans and eventually even Russia and China to America's side to isolate Iran. So I think the best thing would be that Iran, of course, has got many complaints, especially the assassination of Iranian scientists.
Exactly.
That's a separate matter. It must deal with it. It must, in fact, can do better deal with those if it has got friends in the West and in the United States. But it does not, should not interfere with the JCPOA, which was an agreement between Iran and the whole international community, all the five permanent members of the Security Council, plus Germany and also assisted by the Security Council Resolution 2231 and the European community. So I believe the best thing would be, maybe not directly, Mr. Biden has said that Iran should come back to full compliance before he can lift the sanctions. Iran says the ball is in your court, you should lift the sanctions before we go back. I think these are semantics. What needs to be done, maybe through some sort of third-party mediation, is that we should go back to where we were before Trump illegally withdrew from the JCPOA. And then there are many, a host of other issues, many issues, that they have complaints against Iran, and Iran has complaints against America and the West. Then we can discuss those, as we were doing this after the passing of the JCPOA. So I think any rash action, and any action which is sort of, if you like, gives the impression of doing something, but in reality hurts the country, should be avoided. We must abide, and they have said, both Mr. Zarif and President Rouhani have said, that all these measures are reversible, and as Mr. Tarabi said, to some extent they are under supervision of the IAEA, and they can easily be reversed.
Okay.
So what Iran should do is that America should come back to full compliance, lift the sanctions, and Iran will also go back to the full compliance.
Okay, Sam Ahdi Tarabi, a couple things that our guests there said, I'm not too sure if you agree with or not. One of them, bring it back to you. And when he said Iran is in a somewhat weak position, and so is the other side, that's one of the things that he said. And the other thing that I'd like to ask you, Sam Ahdi Tarabi, is the fact that this assassination needs to be used. I mean, blood was spilled, and our guest there says it's two separate matters. Iran's Majlis doesn't think that, and yet the government also has its own line.
The government doesn't even think that. I mean, the things that Dr. Jahanpour, with all due respect to him, and I respect him very much as a scholar, it sounds nice, but it is delusional. That's not the reality of what we had. What we heard from Dr. Jahanpour was not the history of what has happened, it's the mythology of what happened. The reality is that Iran did not have to necessarily negotiate the way it did. Nobody is against negotiations as a tool of statecraft. Everybody agrees. All states negotiate, there's no problem with that. The point is, out of what position do you negotiate? Yes, we were under UN sanctions, but we've always been under UN sanctions. And the fact that you had, at that time, go back to the time, at that time, when the whole process started, which, by the way, started in the Ahmadinejad government. It didn't start in the Rouhani government. It started in the Ahmadinejad government with Dr. Salehi at that time, who was the foreign minister. So the point is that there were many indications at that time that the Russians, that the Chinese, that the Europeans were ready to break international sanctions because it was in their economic interest to do it, not because they cared so much whether the UN Security Council had made rules or not, because they don't. That's not something that's necessarily always the basis for their decision. There are hundreds of examples of where they don't care about the UN Security Council resolutions, and they do things because of their national interest. So it was in their national interest not to lose the emerging Iranian market. The Europeans, the Chinese, the Russians understood this. The Europeans and the Americans were scared that Iran was going to join the BRICS and become part of the BRICS strategic access in the emerging BRICS strategic access. So American elites decided that we're going to do something. We're going to smile. We're going to send some letters. We're going to try to, accept Iran's right to nuclear enrichment, and that way we will get those elites in Iran who are pro-Western to put a final pressure on the system to go into this process. I don't deny that there were positive points about the JCPOA. It's not a black and white issue. The issue is, do you believe that Iran has to come to a strategic agreement with the West? My view is, and the view of a majority of the people in Iran, is that we went through this process, we had this experience. As the leader himself said, this will be an experience. So we went through this experience. In the last speech that he had, he said, we tried negotiating to lift the sanctions, and it didn't work. So this process is now complete. It has been tried and tested empirically on the ground. The Europeans and the Americans do not live up to agreements. So there's no point for us to try to go into another agreement again that's going to be broken by them. And by the way, let me just add another thing.
Quickly,
it was completely legal for Trump under American law to break, to end the JCPOA under American law, because it was an executive order. It never went to the Senate. It was never an international treaty according to American law.
Okay.
And this is one of the things that we told the government at that time.
Very
that
well.
Don't talk about it in this way, because the next president might change it. And at that time, this was said to Dr. Zarif, and Dr. Zarif, it was specifically said to Dr. Zarif, if
right.
Trump becomes president, he will rip it up. He just laughed it off. And that's what ended up
there. I'm sorry, Samati Torabi. Thank you, Director of the Ras Salat Strategic Studies Institute. And thank you very much, Farhang Jahanpour. Wish we had more time. Academic and political analyst there from Oxford, UK. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikova Tahwei and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A vast expanse of Amazon rainforest, seven times larger than Greater London, has been destroyed over the last year as deforestation surges to a 12-year high under Brazil's far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro. Figures released by the Brazilian Space Institute, INPE, on Monday, 30th of November, showed at least 11,088 square kilometers of rainforest was razed between August of 2019 and July of 2020, the highest figure since 2008. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Tom Phillips. The piece is titled, Amazon Deforestation Surges to a 12-Year High Under Bolsonaro. Stay with us for more of Tom Phillips' article. Vast expanse of Amazon rainforest, seven times larger than Greater London, has been destroyed over the last year as deforestation surges to a 12-year high under Brazil's far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro. Figures released by the Brazilian Space Institute, INPE, on Monday, 30th of November, showed at least 11,088 square kilometers of rainforest was razed between August of 2019 and July of 2020, the highest figure since 2008. Carlos Rittel, a Brazilian environmentalist who works at Germany's Institute for Advanced Sustainability Studies, said the numbers were humiliating, shameful, and outrageous, and a clear sign of the damage being done to the environment since Jair Bolsonaro took office in January of 2019. This is an area a third the size of Belgium, gigantic areas of forest that are being lost simply because under Bolsonaro, those who are doing the destroying feel no fear of being punished, Rittel said. Bolsonaro's great achievement when it comes to the environment has been this tragic destruction of forests, which has turned Brazil into perhaps one of the greatest enemies of the global environment and into an international pariah state as well. Brazil's Vice President, Hamilton Mourão, tried to put a positive spin on the bleak figures as he visited INPE's headquarters in the city of São José de Campos on Monday. Hamilton Mourão claimed the annual increase of 9.5% was less than half the anticipated figure of about 20%. We're not here to commemorate any of this because it's nothing to commemorate. But it means that the efforts being launched against Amazon deforestation are starting to yield fruit, Vice President Hamilton Mourão said. Environmentalists, meanwhile, who blame Jair Bolsonaro's deliberate weakening of enforcement efforts for the rise, scoffed at the interpretation provided by Vice President Hamilton Mourão. This number is an outrage. It doesn't tell us anything positive about the Bolsonaro administration at all. On the contrary, it shows that despite the COVID-19 quarantine, environmental crime has increased in Brazil, Carlos Little said. Hamilton Mourão's comment about the smaller-than-expected rise was like saying that we were expecting 300,000 COVID deaths and we only had 200,000, Little added. Christiane Mazzetti, a Greenpeace spokesperson for the Amazon, said, "This is an even worse number than 2019 and a direct reflection of the Bolsonaro administration's anti-environmental policies, which have weakened the monitoring agencies and used misguided strategies to fight deforestation, such as deploying the armed forces rather than environmental protection agents. These numbers show us that we are continuing to move in the wrong direction than the one needed to deal with the climate emergency and the biodiversity crisis." The Observatoria de Clima group said soaring destruction comes as no surprise to those following the dismantling of environmental policy that has been underway in Brazil since January of 2019. The numbers simply show that Jair Bolsonaro's plan has worked. They are the result of a successful project to annihilate the ability of the Brazilian state and its monitoring agencies to care for our forests and fight crime in the Amazon rainforest, it said in a statement. Hamilton Mourão said the figures, which were produced with information from the PRODE satellite system, showed most of the devastation was occurring in four regions of the Amazon: the Pará state, the north of Mato Grosso state, and the south of Amazonas state and Rondônia. Pará state, a long-time deforestation hotspot, was by far the worst affected state, accounting for almost 47% of the total deforestation. "Thanks to INPA's work, we now have a perfect sense of where we need to focus our actions in order to prevent illegal activities occurring," Vice President Hamilton Mourão told reporters, praising his brilliant scientists for their efforts. But despite a growing green government propaganda campaign, which recently saw Mourão take foreign ambassadors on a tour of the Amazon region, environmentalists and foreign investors are skeptical about its efforts to protect the world's biggest rainforest. During the three-day excursion, foreign ambassadors were not taken to any of the deforestation hotspots, which Hamilton Mourão detailed on Monday. An activist dismissed the visit as simply a sham. In May of this year, thousands of Brazilian troops were sent to the Amazon rainforest, supposedly to fight environmental crime, although many believe they are merely making things much worse. Carlos Rittel said one ray of light was the recent defeat of Bolsonaro's key international ally, President Donald Trump. Without the backing of Trump in the United States, the international pressure on Bolsonaro over the environment will increase, and it will increase a lot, he predicted. Jair Bolsonaro is one of only a tiny group of world leaders who has yet to recognize President-elect Joe Biden's victory, and on Sunday claimed, without proof, that unnamed sources have convinced him that the US elections had been plagued with fraud.
Good morning. morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.